Good morning, and welcome again to our conference in Rabbi Shimshon Raphael Hirsch. I want to first of all thank our sponsors, J. Richard and Dorothy Schiff and family, Michael and Marsha Lax, Stanley and Alana Emerson. We're very grateful for their support. I wanted to introduce now Rabbi Dr. Adam Furtziger, who is the Gwendolyn and Joseph Strauss Fellow in Jewish Studies at Bar-Ilan University, where he teaches and serves as the Associate Director in the Graduate Program in Contemporary Jewry. Dr. Furtziger has lectured for us before at Torah in Motion, and as you all know, his talks are very thoughtful and very stimulating. His book, Exclusion and Hierarchy, Orthodoxy, Non-Observance, and the Emergence of Modern Jewish Identity, was published by Penn in June 2005. It's a very, very interesting and important study, actually, of the kinds of issues and changes that take place within Orthodoxy and between Orthodoxy and other denominations as the Enlightenment emerges. For this talk, Dr. Furtziger is going to address Rabbi Hirsch's attitude towards Zionism.
Would it be very rude of me if I asked people to move up a little bit? Because, you know, we have the potential for intimacy here, and it certainly would be more comfortable for me. And do you have a portable mic, too? Yeah, I think I'd like that better. That would be great. The portable mics are good, except that sometimes you get radio signals coming through. So we'll hopefully, either we'll study or we'll dance, depending on what, you know, comes through. That's good. Okay, so thank you very much. And I see already some familiar faces, some new faces. And again, it's my second time here in Toronto. And it's a pleasure to be here, and the Rabbi Kelman and Dr. Malamet really have made tremendous efforts and continue to do so in Torah in Motion, and I'm also through a little bit, even in my own research about contemporary Jewry, aware of what's going on here, and I think it's very important, and I do feel that it's important also to tell the people who make the efforts on a Sunday morning, a winter Sunday morning to come, that it's important. It's recognized, and people come from Israel and see it, and it's actually very inspiring for us to see people who are engaged and are interested. Okay, so I apologize to people who heard me before, but I will have to make a few background statements regarding Hirsch, some of which I said already in the previous lecture, in order that that we have the proper backdrop for for this lecture. I'd also like to mention, and it's relevant to the previous lecture before, you know, there are two approaches, there are probably more, but there are two approaches to when people study, especially issues of hashkafa, of ideology. Some people, what they want to hear is what they believe in. In other words, I believe something, and therefore what I want to hear is someone who can strengthen my belief, someone who can enrich my own commitment. And that is a very valuable thing, and we do that all the time in synagogue, through prayers, through different declarations that we make. We do that through the Passover Seder. Where there is a whole legacy in Jewish life of doing that. Study of texts or study of whether it be Talmud or whether it be other Jewish books or history, philosophy, is just not like that. It's more an exercise in confronting ideas, confronting people who have thought rigorously about things, and then digesting them ourselves. And the reason, I think it should be obvious to most of us, and probably this is a self-selected group, and the people who are here are people who are used to that type of critical thinking. But the reason I'm saying it is particularly relevant to the lecture that I'm going to give now. Because once again, we have this interesting figure who has become the symbol of maybe the founder of modern Orthodoxy. That's how Shimshon Raphael Hirsch is perceived. And to a certain degree, rightfully so, because he was the person who articulated most clearly in an early period, in the early part of the modern era, he articulated a positive approach to modern life. He articulated the idea that there is no conflict between Torah and secular society, high culture, literature, etc. He adapted a phrase from the Mishnah, from Tanaic literature, from Avot, Yafet Torah im Derech Eretz, which, according to almost all pre-modern explanations, has nothing to do with culture. Derech Eretz is not culture. It also has nothing to do with what my father used to say to me when I was a kid. No, a little Derech Eretz. You ever hear that one? Right? That's not what the Mishnah means. Derech Eretz means Parnassa. It means that that rabbi who said that statement in the Mishnah was saying that a person who learns Torah should also have a Parnassa, should also have make a living, and that is why so many of the rabbis in the Talmud did both. You know, they were sandlarim, they fixed shoes, or they did other types of things. So that is probably the almost absolutely, if you go through the commentaries, the original meaning of that phrase. And Hirsch offers a new interpretation. Now we say Shivim Panim LaTorah. There are 70 faces of the Torah, and the Torah allows for homiletics. That is the whole midrashic tradition that we have. But it should be clear that what happens here is that we have something which was written in the around the year 200 of the Common Era, and Hirsch, looking at that phrase in the context of his own world, he draws the conclusion that there is an additional aspect to this phrase which is particularly relevant to the world in which he lived in. Yafet Talmud Torah im Derech Eretz, study of Torah or Torah is yafet. It's not allowed. It's not mutar Torah im Derech Eretz. It's not permissible. Yafet. It's beautiful. It's aesthetic. It's ideal. And this is his carrying call. This is the educational philosophy, which becomes the basis for day schools, for Bar Ilan University, for Yeshiva University, for all types of frameworks in which there is a dual curriculum, in which it's lichatchila. It's not if in order to get state funds we have to teach a little mathematics, but rather in order to be an ideal Jew in contemporary society, one must come to the table both with an intensive, rigorous knowledge of Torah and commitment to Torah, together with significant and rigorous exposure to secular knowledge, to culture that is common to all human beings, certainly in your local society. Now, this is very enlightened for its times, and Hirsch, in one of his most, I think, profound statements or most telling statements, in 1836, he publishes his first book, which is called, it's called 19 Briefe, 19 Letters. It's maybe still his most famous book. It's a book in which you have a dialogue between two young Jews, college age, one who has become a young rabbi, and the other who has, his name is Naftali, and the other who has gone off to university and has sort of left the, what we say today, the derech, and has lots and lots of questions about the traditional religion that he was brought up with. So the first question, the first letter is all the questions. It's Binyamin, who says, you know, the rabbis don't understand us. You know, this religion isn't relevant to our world. You know, I went to university, I heard all these new ideas, etc. And then the subsequent 18 letters are Naftali's responses on topic after topic after topic. And we're going to look at one of those letters in a few moments. The book was published anonymously because the publisher thought Hirsch wasn't famous enough and no one would buy it if it has some rabbi that no one ever heard of. Later on, they put his name to it when he became famous and when his other books were big sellers. But there's a hint to who the author is actually in the names. Hirsch, what does Hirsch mean in German? Not a lion, a deer, right? A deer. And in Genesis 49, we have the brachot, we have the blessings that Jacob gives to his sons. And when he gets to his son Naftali, does anyone recall the pasuk, the verse? It says, Naftali ayala shelucha hanoten imre shafer. That Naftali is a swift deer. So when the young rabbi, who is this enlightened rabbi who has answers to all the questions, is named Naftali, he's saying, me. Right? Saying, I am Naftali. Right? And I am going to give you my world view. Okay? So it's very astute and elegant way of introducing his world view, his Weltanschauung, to his readership. But there's another piece to this that I think is interesting, relevant, and this is maybe more a little bit it stems from my background as a critical scholar. The first letter is from Binyamin, with all the doubts and questions about Judaism, its relevancy, etc. Who wrote that letter? Hirsch. So, it's not just the answers that are Hirsch. The questions are also Hirsch, too. Now, Hirsch was a young rabbinical student who then went off to the University of Bonn and ran a workshop on Judaism with Abraham Geiger, who is later the leading reform rabbi of his time. And they discussed the burning issues of the time. So not only is Hirsch familiar with these questions, but at a young age, he probably had them himself. His conclusions were diametrically opposed to those of Geiger, although you can find parallels. But yet, when one reads something, especially one in which there are numerous identities, you have to always remember who's the author. And the author chooses different ways of expressing his or her opinion. So what is the catchphrase that is very interesting? He says, there are two types of rabbis. This is Binyamin says, that I have encountered. One type of rabbi are these young rabbis who take sledgehammers. And they walk over to synagogues, and with those sledgehammers, they go, and they break the walls of the synagogue. Who are those rabbis? Those are the reform rabbis. Those are the new young upstarts who are claiming that there is this new way and that we can reject the ways of the past, and the ways of the past are irrelevant to our emancipatory world. He says there's another group of rabbis who sit in the synagogue with their rostrums, their shtenders. They read Talmud and just sit there as the walls fall down upon them and don't move and don't do anything. Who are those rabbis? The traditional, the prima, the ones, the rabbis, a lot of them Polish, some of them German, who are living in a new era and are just conducting themselves exactly the way they did for hundreds and hundreds of years. Which one is Hirsch criticizing? Both. That's the point. Here he sees himself as a maverick, as a new person who is, as my professor and mentor, Jacob Katz of blessed memory, said, "Hamiyamin umismail." He is against the right and against the left. I want to take a break for a second. I don't want to lose train of thought. There's something very important I meant to start with. I'm very blessed that I have a grandmother. My mother's mother is 100 years old. And in fact, last week, I live in Israel, but I had the privilege to spend 3 days with her in L.A. last week. I was giving lectures at a number of universities there. And it was a wonderful visit, and she's actually, we interacted, and she's great, and she knows my kids, and I have a son in the Army, and we talked about everything. It was great. Anyway, I got here Friday and Saturday night. I heard she had a massive stroke. And it's pretty clear the direction. And, you know, that's sad because that's sad, you know. But it's a celebration of life. She had a wonderful life. She had a great 100th birthday. My kids know her. My daughter made a project about her in school last week. So it's not a tragedy. But I don't know how to say it exactly because I don't know whether refuah shlema in the normative sense is the right application here. But I do want to dedicate my teaching here to her appropriate and what God sees fit to be appropriate, and hopefully that will be painless and helpful in the way that it should be to her existence. And I'm very, very, her name is Etta Greenfield Bodoff, and she really is an inspiration to me and will be, Bezrat Hashem, for many, many years to come. But we're at a liminal stage in our family, and it's not something I can ignore. So I did want to share that with you. Okay. Now, we, and it's a royal we, and I don't know if we all agree with this, and maybe in a complicated post-Lebanon intifada, even post-Gaza era, the Jewish world is not as one position. But let us just say, certainly, many of the people in this room are affiliated on some level, not everybody, and with modern Orthodox Judaism. And modern Orthodoxy in North America has, certainly since the mid-20th century, been extremely Zionistic and extremely supportive of the state of Israel. And till this day, particularly today, the vast majority of young North American families and individuals who come to Israel are those who are educated in modern Orthodox institutions and educated on Zionism as a central value, a central value. There is a conflict. Does Zionism mean settling? Does Zionism mean supporting? But we won't get into that. What I'm trying to establish here is that if Hirsch is the paradigm of modern Orthodoxy, if Hirsch symbolizes this Torah, im derech eretz, Torah and culture and ways of the world and society, one would assume that Hirsch would have a positive view of the reestablishment of productive Jewish life and independent Jewish political life in the historic land of Israel. Now, we should be careful, of course. Hirsch died in 1888. He lived from 1808 to 1888, so it's 200-plus years, the birthday today. And Hirsch lived before Herzl. So political Zionism in its formal sense, which really began officially in 1897 with the first Zionist Congress, is something which he didn't engage. But even before Herzl, there were significant figures who were developing the idea of settlement in the land of Israel as a solution to Jewish to anti-Semitism, to Jewish problems. And there were also people, some of them close colleagues of Hirsch, who saw this in messianic terms, people who were precursors of Rav Kook, who became sort of the most significant religious Zionist thinker, who really, people like Rabbi Kalischer, who saw moving to Israel and reestablishing Jewish independent life there as a step towards the messianic age. Hirsch also was aware of tremendous anti-Semitism going on in Eastern Europe at that time, and the whole question of what to do, how to resettle, how to find a way for these Jews to survive after the numerous pogroms and a government persecution of the Jews. So, again, despite the fact that it is pre-Herzl, there was a lot of what we call proto-Zionist or Chibat Zion, love of Zion, which is in the air. And we also have settlements, you know, people who traveled to Israel in the 1880s. We have the establishment of Rishon LeZion, of Zichron Yaakov, of Rosh Hanikra, Rosh Pina, excuse me, of Petach Tikva, Yoel Solomon. We have the new Yishuv integrating a little bit into Jerusalem. So here's, if you're a big leader, and he was a big leader, he's the most important Orthodox rabbi in Germany. He was the rabbi from 1851 to 1888 in Frankfurt, one of the most important Jewish communities in Germany. He's aware of this, and he has to respond to this. So one would assume that Hirsch would be very positive and would see this the way that many of us do today as part of that integrationist, or we'll call it synthetic combination, right? Like, just to take a catchphrase, and maybe we'll go back to it at the end, there might be people here who are in the Bnei Akiva organization. What is Bnei Akiva organization's motto? Anyone remember? Torah va'avodah. Torah and productive work. Now, that's a little different than Torah im Derech Eretz, but it's not so different. It's a twist. But what makes it similar is that it's synthetic. It's a combination. It's saying Torah im, Torah with. Torah doesn't have to stand alone. It's not Torah only. It's Torah with something else as an ideal, positive way of conduct and an ideal to strive for. So the person who really made famous this idea Torah im Derech Eretz, one would assume that he would resonate as well to the idea of Torah va'avodah, for example. So now, having said this, one may be a little bit disappointed to find out that that is not the case at all. And I really apologize because of travels and faxes and stuff like that. This sheet did not arrive here, so I'm going to have to read it to you, and you're not going to have it in front of you, and I hate doing that. But anyway, that's what we're going to do. We're in the 16th letter, you can read it yourselves, of the 19 letters. This is something that Hirsch wrote already early on, and it's consistent throughout his life. And Hirsch has asked the following question. What should be the perspective, or he raises the question, what should be the perspective of the Jews on what's called political emancipation? What does political emancipation mean? It means that rather than Jews living as a separate entity with minimal political involvement, legal involvement with greater society, Jews become citizens in every way, like we are today. And they have their religion, but their religion has nothing to do with their political status, has nothing to do with their relationship to the rest of society. They join the army, they can be elected officials, they have every right of anyone else. Jews didn't have that anywhere in Europe until the French Revolution, maybe in one place, but basically in 1889 in Europe, in 1789 in Europe, in 1776 in the United States. The United States is very unique in that the United States begins as an emancipated society. European societies begin as feudal societies, as corporate societies, and only in the late 18th century and in the 19th century do we have a process of emancipation. Yeah. Well, church and state is part of it, but we shouldn't mix them up, because in Europe there is no separation of church and state. In Canada, not either. Canada, they give funding for day schools, right? Church and state is in a I know there's a lot of debates about I know that somebody here is involved in that, but let's say, if I'm not mistaken, on the Canadian census, you can ask if a person's Jewish, and you can ask what their orientation is. In America, it is illegal to ask on the U.S. census if a person, what their religion is. America has a very strict interpretation of church and state. So that's a different story. Once you did mention it, I do have to say, mention a very interesting paradox. Very important French historian and philosopher by the name of Alexis de Tocqueville. And my French is lousy, so you can correct me if my accent was Torontonian and not Montrealian. Right? Alexis de Tocqueville. And he had some money, and he was interested. And in the 1830s, he took a boat from France, and he decided he wants to discover and learn about the new democracy called America, because it's this nascent state. And he spent a couple months traveling around the United States, and he wrote a book called Democracy in America, which is considered a classic in political history and philosophy. But I remember, actually I heard this for the first time, not from a historian, but actually from Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, the chief rabbi of the United Synagogue in England. He made this interesting comment in the context of Israel, but it's kind of worthwhile hearing. De Tocqueville says, and I've taught this subsequently from the text, Tocqueville says, it's really interesting, you know, I come from France, which is an emancipated country, going back to your question, but it's a country in which there is no separation between church and state, where rabbis are paid by the state, where the synagogues and the churches are funded by the state, etc., and the churches are empty. And I come to America where there's a total separation between church and state, and people who know America well know outside of New York, Los Angeles, Miami, Boca, maybe, and Chicago, America is a very, very religious country. Very Christian. So I go to America, there's total separation between church and state, and the churches are full. And it's a very interesting comment, and it's relevant to me as a Jew living in Israel in terms of trying to grapple with the question of whether religious coercion is good for Torah or bad for Torah, and whether if you allow people the choice rather than forcing them, will that make them more committed, less committed? I don't have an answer to it, but reading de Tocqueville certainly raises those issues. Okay, getting back to our text. So the question is like this. Most of the rabbis, Orthodox rabbis, say emancipation is dangerous. We're going to assimilate. We're going to become alienated from Torah. Once Jews don't have legal statutes which keep them part of their community, they will acculturate and they will lose their Jewish identity or will become significantly weakened. The Reform see it the opposite way. The Reform see it as Judaism must be a part of society, that modernity is the ideal, and therefore Jews must be as much a part of that as possible. And in fact, part of the growth of Reform is to create an aesthetic, culturally appealing religion which can allow for a Jew to be both part of, both societies. Now, what is the man who is not Reform, right, but is also critical of the rabbis? What does he think about emancipation? Hirsch thinks emancipation is the best thing that ever happened. He feels, as we'll see momentarily, that the Jews were commanded on Sinai to be a mamlechet kohanim and a goy kadosh, a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. That Isaiah said that the Jews, their goal in this world is to be an or lagoyim, to be a light onto the nations, lefakeach einaim ivriot, to open the eyes of the blind, which means to be the messengers of an ethical, enlightened, God-given position in this world. And here says, for 2,000 years, we have been stymied. We have been relegated to ghetto civilization, ghetto existence, and therefore we could never fulfill the reason we got the Torah.
The whole reason we got the Torah is to communicate God's ideas to the world. Along comes emancipation. You rabbis who reject this, you don't understand. This is what we came to this earth for. This is why God gave us the Torah, so that we could be part of the world and that we could communicate our message. Hirsch's ideal character is called a Mensch Yisrael. I mentioned it in the previous lecture. And we'll get back to, okay? A Mensch Yisrael. I'll even tell you who he talks about. He says, a Jewish banker. Not wealthy necessarily. A person who's a clerk. Who 4 days a week works extra hours. Is very intensive. Is very straight as an arrow. Is very moral. Very, very ethical in their professional behavior. And everyone sees them as the ideal worker. Friday comes along in the winter, and they work very hard, but they look at the clock at 3:30 in the afternoon, and they get up, put their stuff in their bag, and say, have a good weekend, and go home. What will the people in their office say, if they're ethical and straight people? They'll say, wow, this person is so committed to his work, is such a good worker, such a straight person. But when his God calls him, he gets up and leaves everything. What a beautiful religion. What an ethical religion. What a true religion this is. That is the Mensch Yisrael who goes home and has a Shabbat according to the halakha, according to Jewish statutes. Hirsch sees that Mensch Yisrael as the ideal. But that Mensch Yisrael can never exist in a pre-emancipatory world because the Jew isn't doesn't have the language ability, doesn't have the education, doesn't have the cultural discourse, doesn't have the tools to communicate that message. So as far as Hirsch's concerned, being an Orthodox Jew means being an ethical Jew. Being an Orthodox ethical Jew is not something that one does just within one's home. It's something that one celebrates through one's interaction with society. That can only take place when Jews are completely integrated in society, accepted, and flourish. Now, we will hopefully at some point, is there someone here who knows the time framework? Because I know I was told I have a little extra time. And at what time we're supposed to end? 11:15. Okay, he told me I have a little extra time, but I just want to make sure we get things in. If people raise questions about the naivete of Hirsch, having grown up in a German context, looking at things retrospectively, I think you're absolutely on the mark. But that's not what we're up to yet. Okay, so Hirsch writes in 1836 the following. It is certainly possible for us to attach ourselves to the state wherever we may find ourselves without harm to the spirit of Judaism. Now listen to this, okay? With your Zionist lenses on. After all, our former independent statehood did not represent the essence or the purpose of Israel's national existence, but merely a means to the fulfillment of its spiritual task. The bond of Israel's unity was at no time land and soil, but only the common task of keeping the Torah. In consequence, Israel still today constitutes one entity, even though it is far from its land and in exile is joined to other nations. So, land and soil are not Jewish things. National identity in the general world sense of things is not what Judaism is about. It's not. In another place, Hirsch says something rhetorical, which is ingenious, though it's not really accurate, but, you know, he says, note that all the major spiritual accomplishments of the Jewish people throughout history took place where? Outside of Israel. The Exodus, the receipt of the Torah, Sinai, outside of Israel. The Babylonian Talmud was the one that was strong, was considered the more authoritative than the Jerusalem Talmud. Maimonides, we can go on and on. And of course we could debate that, but again, it does testify to the genius of this man and his ability to appropriate various historical facts in a way which buttresses his opinion and his strong argument, and it also shows how clear he was about this. Now, tell me something. But if this is a reform rabbi, we say, good, here's just rejecting all sorts of stuff that Jews believe in. But what did those people pray this morning? Didn't you make these prayers like, may we blow a horn, a shofar, for our freedom, and may it be the beginning of our ingathering, return to our soil. Don't we say prayers in the Birkat HaMazon, in the grace after meals? Uvenei Yerushalayim Ir HaKodesh Mehera B'Yameinu. May God bring about the rebuilding of the Jerusalem. Bonei Yerushalayim, and I can go on and on. V'techazena einenu b'shuvcha l'tzion brachamim. May we see the return to Zion. These are classical Jewish prayers. And Hirsch, as opposed to the Reform, was not willing to change the prayer book. Hirsch doesn't say, take out the korbanot, take out the sacrifices because they don't apply anymore. Hirsch doesn't say we can change things because they're irrelevant. Hirsch says we are Orthodox and we believe in the same Torah and we read the same Torah and our values have not changed. Yet we are integrated into modern life. So again, I said it sort of last, Hirsch's opinion would be much easier if it was coming from a Reformed Jew in this case. It's much harder to understand coming from someone who is considered the hero of modern Orthodoxy. So what's the major principle that Hirsch seems to be rejecting when he says land and soil are not ideals, are not things we should be striving for? Well, pre-Zionism, even if you're not a Zionist, you're Haredi, or you're, you know, what does it say? Well, you know, what do Jews believe in? They believe in Messiah. They believe in return, ingathering of the exile, Shivat Zion, Kibbutz Galuyot, return from the diaspora. So, if you're a Reform Jew, you say, we don't believe in that anymore, right? You say, that was an ancient belief, but today that is not our ideal. But if you're an Orthodox Jew, and you're navigating between what we like to call tradition and modernity, well, we see his modernity here very, very, very directly. What about tradition? Has he rejected tradition? So then he answers us, one day, God will again reunite the Jews outwardly too, as a people gathered on its soil, and the Torah will again form the constitution of a state, serving as a model and a manifestation of God and the human mission. So you say, oh, this is just temporary. This is just b'di'evit. Hirsch is a good religious Zionist, and he's saying, yes, we're going to create a Torah state. That's what it sounds like for a second. But then he says, this is the future which we have been promised and which forms the goal of the galut, the exile. We should long for it, listen carefully, but we must not actively work to bring it about. That is the ultimate of anti-Zionism. The Zionist revolution is not the Jews should return to the land of Israel. Everyone who is committed to Jewish tradition cannot reject the idea that the Jews will ultimately return to the land of Israel. The Zionist revolution is the belief that Jews should actively work to return and should take the mantle into their own hands, should not wait passively as Jews did for so many centuries while God decided when to send that magic carpet. Zionism is about activism. That is the crucial point of departure of Zionism from pre-modern Jewish political perspectives. Activism. Whether you're a secular Zionist, whether you're a labor Zionist, social Zionist or a religious Zionist. There cannot be a Zionist who rejects activism. You can say that I will stay in the exile, but I must support activism. You can't. Zionism is activism. It's a new perception of Jewish history. It's saying we are going to take our destiny into our own hands. We will pray and help that God will help us. Or as one of my rabbis often likes to quote from the prophets, Shuvu Elai Va'ashuva Elechem. If you will come closer to me, I will return in kind. It is in a religious Zionist perspective, a partnership. But it is a partnership. It is not a baby crying, waiting for their parent to pick them out of the crib. It is a grown person who hopes that if they are mishtadel, if they do the right thing, then they will receive support from other forces. Hirsch rejects that. We should long for it, but we must not actively work to bring it about. It was actually interesting this morning. I was praying in the synagogue in Or HaChaim, in the local Zionist yeshiva. And Rabbi Kelman, you know, is very excited about this Hirsch conference. So he brings over to me a prayer book of that was with the commentary of Hirsch. So he says, you see, we have one here too. So I opened it up to the Shmona Asrei, to the 18, 19 blessings. And I showed him where on that prayer, Tekah b'shofar gadol cheruteinu, we should blow a shofar for the return to the land of Israel, that they actually copied this piece that I just wrote, and he says, we should blow a shofar and we all have to pray to go back to the land of Israel, but no active, it's right there in the Siddur, and Siddurim are the most effective forms of disseminating ideas for two reasons, because they're used all the time and because many people are bored in prayer. So they're looking for something to do, and if there's a good commentary, especially if it's in English, they'll read it, right? How many people grew up on the Hertz Chumash, right? And how influential was Hertz in your, you know, Torah learning because you were bored? I'm an educator, you know? You're bored. How many times could you read the Torah over and over again? You started reading Hertz, or if you were a little bit more righteous, you did it between the aliyot, right? So, similarly, it's, okay, we'll give people the benefit of the doubt. It's the chazarat hashatz, it's the repetition. So they've said it already. They're looking for something to do. They look around, and what does Hirsch tell you? You should know when you're praying for the return to the Holy Land, make sure you realize all you can do is pray. And you shouldn't do anything active. Now he goes on. We are still being educated for this future so that we will then exemplify Israel in prosperity more truly. This future will go hand in hand with the elevation of all humanity to universal brotherhood under God, the one alone. When will we return to the land? When the Messiah comes, which is a nice way of saying we don't have to deal with it. Okay? We don't have to deal with it. Of course, we believe in the Messiah, but Messiah is very convenient. Because as long as you say it's in the time of the Messiah, you can avoid it completely. Just one second. If I read this to you, you would tell me that it was either written by a Reform Jew or it was written by the Satmar Rebbe, Rabbi Yoel Teitelbaum, who in wake of the Holocaust in particular saw Zionism as the demonization of Judaism, and he saw any active efforts to resettle the land or to create an active presence in the land as being contrary or even destructive to the future of the people. And some of his most extreme followers have even done crazy things like, you know, go to conferences in Iran last year, right? So when you read this, you say, this sounds like the Satmar Rebbe. But it's this man who wore morning suits and who, like I said, didn't make his students wear kippot during secular studies in his school and spoke a beautiful German, wrote a beautiful German, and thought that you should, you know, go to the theater and learn, read Kant, and you should, you know, integrate and everything. And so there's, you know, when I think that what's interesting, again, about this conference here is that the more simplistic, or I think the, you know, people are taught, here's Torah im Derech Eretz. But here, Rabbi Kelman and Dr. Melman are saying, yes, this man is a model, but he's a complex model. And the more you learn about Hirsch, you realize that he was an independent thinker, he was an influential person, but he was complex and trying to figure out the balance between his various the various aspects of this person is very is complicated. But I want to hear two comments or questions, or and then if you what's our framework again in terms of time? We have 5 minutes. Okay, so let me just say one thing, and then we'll open it up to questions. Okay, well, actually, two comments. The two comments, or we'll even make them three quick ones. Comment number one, bullets. Okay, number one. Number one is that I alluded to it. I think it is hard sometimes to see. Hirsch was a product of what we call secular messianism of the 19th century, when everyone thought this brave new world was upon us, and Jews were becoming emancipated, and everything was hunky dory, and everything was going to be great, and we were really going to fulfill this mission. And now we know what happened in Germany to this wonderful ideal society. So when you read it that way, it's hard, and you say this person was very naive, and Jews were very naive. Someone pointed a book to me that I've read already, but I encourage you to read it, even though it doesn't talk about orthodoxy, Amos Elon's book, The Pity of It All. Read that book. It's a very interesting book which describes how attached Jews were to German life. And that book is about secular Jews, but Hirsch really fits into that. He is so attached and so clear to him that Germany is a promised land for the Jews in terms of fulfilling their mission, that, you know, again, post-Holocaust, it's very hard sometimes to swallow this, but this is it, you know, here I'll be a little bit of a Zionist. Of course, it's always easy to criticize Hirsch. It's harder for us to be self-reflective, but that's the nature of human beings. And they say, Vamevin Yavin. The other point of Hirsch is that I don't think, despite his clear lack of appreciation for Zionism, that he didn't influence Zionism. Many of his Talmidim, many of his students, many of the people who were educated in the schools that he started were Zionists. They started the religious kibbutz movement. They started Bnei Akiva. They were ministers in governments. How could that be? And the reason is because even though Hirsch rejected Zionism, he created a model, Torah and his was Torah and culture. But as soon as you create an integrative model, a synthetic model, you've opened up the possibility for what to make the plus. Torah and culture, Torah and avodah, Torah umada, Torah and science, Torah and modernity, Torah and tolerance, Torah and ecology. But the basic paradigm, the formula that begins is the formula saying Torah can be positively integrated. So many of his students and his followers or descendants even followed Hirsch in that integrated approach, and yet they did not accept his perception of Zionism. Do you want to tell me something? I'll have to go. I'm sorry, everybody. That's my no. Just kidding. Yeah. Okay. Okay. And one more comment before we open it up is that I said self-reflective, and I implied some things, but I wanted to say that as an Israeli, I've been living in Israel for 21 years. My oldest son is in the army. The son living in volunteering in 12th grade in Sderot this year. We're very much a part of Israeli Religious Zionist Society. That I think that learning Hirsch is very helpful. Because Hirsch reminds us, whether I think that he takes it to an extreme that I'm not comfortable with, he reminds us that living in the land of Israel isn't just about physical, political, economic development. It's about spiritual development. It's about values. It's about musar. It's about being a certain type of nation. And if we only see it as a physical presence and we reject the other aspect, then we're obviously doing something wrong. And I think that it's a tension that we in Israel are trying to find. We're only 60-some-odd years in the process. But I think that that is a tension. But again, reading Hirsch and his critique of what material culture and material society can do, how it can pervert a nation which for so many years was based on spiritual and intellectual prowess, to me, as a religious Zionist, doesn't make me reject Zionism, but it makes me realize how important it is to assert those values within the beautiful political, material society that we have created. Now, I'd like to hear your comments. Go ahead. I think they want you to walk up to the microphone.
So I'm wondering what motivated his concern with Zionism. Was he concerned that if Jews have an ideal of going to a different country, in the eyes of the Germans, they're not really a part of our society? Was that his concern, or was it his concern that the state of Zionism or the rumblings of Zionism then would replace Torah, that Zionism would be nationalism and would denigrate Torah? Which of those was?
I belong to the Bayit Shul, I don't know if you know, in Thornhill, and actually the rabbi was speaking yesterday about the portion of the week when the Jews were escaping from Egypt, and there was a part, I can't remember the Hebrew, but he was saying that God put himself behind the Jewish people. Now that, I think Rashi said that that was a form of protecting the people from the Egyptians, But then he said that Rabbi Hirsch had a comment that the reason, are you familiar with this? It's in the Chumash that the reason he put himself behind the Jewish people was to allow the Jews to take the initiative to put some work into their own defense, to act for themselves, to be proactive. And he was actually relating that to modern-day circumstances in Israel and saying how Jews are obligated. And this was from Rabbi Hirsch. It seems to contradict what you were saying. So when you came up with that, I kind of like I like Rabbi Taub's interpretation better.
Paganism to activism was related to active settlement in the land of Israel. He couldn't avoid the fact that the tradition of what we read yesterday is about Nachshon. It's about that man who jumped in before the miracle, right? But he didn't perceive that in terms of changing Jewish history. He perceived that in terms of Jews being integrated in society, being active in various forms, and not being completely, you know, he was a modern. Now, that's the point. He was a modern. He wasn't a person who was sitting, remember the rabbi who just sat there in the synagogue while the walls came down? So he rejected that. That's a level of activism. But the level of historic, panhistoric activism that Zionism demands, that was not at all where he was at. But it would be interesting for you to share what I said with your rabbi, and I'd be interested to hear how he would respond to it. Do we have time for one more comment? Okay, thank you very much, and it was a pleasure to be with you.